Hey, Rachel Vickery. Try not to swear. How are you? You all right?
I'm great. Thank you so much.
And apologies, as you've already noticed, I do look extremely tired. I haven't had much sleep, so that's why I look really tired. What are you up to? What's been going on in your world?
Yeah, not much. Just keeping busy, running workshops with pretty cool people and helping good people do difficult things. So, just normal day of the mill, run of the mill stuff, really.
I like it, helping good people do difficult things. Do you want to, for me and the listeners, tell me the story so far? Because obviously we've spent a couple of days together. I'm still quite stressed thinking about it. All I kept thinking, and but you weren't in the room with, you were in the room was when someone left our room and someone in the corridor shouted, "Get in this room now." More of that later.
Yeah.
God,
So, for clarity for our listeners, your listeners, were you stressed about spending the 2 days together? Because that's how it sounded, or were you stressed about the context of those 2 days?
well, I think it was awesome today, but and fair play to the people that took part in it. But it was some challenging scenarios, really. And I'm sweating already. So yeah, cool. Tell me the story so far. Well, then we'll talk about those days, and then we'll find out what you know.
All right, no stress at all. So I'm a Kiwi, so a New Zealander, for those of you who aren't familiar with what a Kiwi is. But I live in Australia, so I've been living in Australia for 20 years. Originally started my sport background as an elite gymnast. So I was 6 years on the New Zealand team, did Commonwealth Games World Champs, qualified as a sport physiotherapist after that. And then I guess added a whole lot of other things to my professional bow along the way, including, some exercise physiology, some sport biomechanics, a lot of the hard sciences, some psychotherapy, which was quite left field, and had and have a real professional interest, I guess, in early days anyway, doing a lot of stuff with breathing from a performance perspective. So not breathing for mindfulness, meditation, yoga, that sort of soft, what's often perceived as softer or crystal waving stuff, more of the kick-ass performance side. And that led me down, I guess, professional and personal interest on the human threat response and what happens to humans when they're in high pressure and high stakes environments. And some of that had come from my personal background as a gymnast. And then I guess over the years culminated in what I was seeing and hearing from clients when I was working as a sports physio, and a whole lot of stuff that was just falling through the gaps. And humans and human behavior just fascinates me. So it was really a permission slip to kind of dive deep into what makes humans tick and how do we make sure that they can execute in high pressure moments. These days, that's pretty much predominantly what I do. So I wasn't really joking when I said working with good people doing difficult things. What I left off that was where the pressure and the stakes is high. So whether that be elite military or professional teams or, surgeons in the OR, some corporate stuff as well, where people are needing to execute under pressure, where the stakes are high. And amongst all of that, obviously have a pretty strong no dickhead policy. So that's where the good people piece comes in. So that's probably in a nutshell. And I've probably undersold everything, but that's how we roll.
Wow, there we go. But even just breathing, I've heard loads of people speaking about breathing recently. And again, I don't know that much about it. Like box breathing, I heard the other day. Again, I just don't know anything. I am breathing though, just in case you're concerned about it. Yeah, again, just whole aspects of performance, I guess I've not gone into too much. And then I'm thinking, how is someone from gymnastics like? And I guess I would definitely be interested in what it is that's led you to this. And so I imagine I used to swim a bit, and I remember sitting on the chair before the swimming thinking, I just want to die now. Actually, I don't want to swim.
Yeah, and that's a common experience. Hey, so for me as a gymnast, I had this really difficult move that I would do to get up onto the beam, and the beam is 10 centimeters wide, so it's not particularly wide, so the margin error is not great. and it's quite high, and most gymnasts are relatively short. So relatively, it feels like you're a long way off the ground when you're standing on top of it. And the beam is usually the event that most gymnasts are most nervous competing because, you know, the margin of error is so little. So you can, if you fall off the beam, the penalty is so high that it'll shift you from a gold medal position to maybe bottom of the, you know, bottom third of the field. So there's a lot of pressure. And in gymnastics is a sport, you know, I know you're familiar with it, where it's quite a toxic, high pressure environment, just as it is anyway, from some of the coaches, you know, some, especially some of the older, more traditional coaching methodologies. So I'd have this move, and it was basically I'd come into the beam, I'd tumble into the beam, the springboard would be at the end of the beam, I'd land on the springboard, but now facing backwards. So it's a blind entry somersault, backwards somersault to land on one leg. So even, you know, margin of error is even smaller because you don't see the beam and you have to land on one leg. So it was a move that was ranked as one of the most difficult beam mounts back when I was competing, which was in the mid-90s, and it's still one of the most difficult beam mounts. And if it was competition, that didn't matter, or if it was training, I would land that skill 10 out of 10 times, no problems whatsoever. But if it was a really big competition, including Commonwealth Games, I'd be on the beam, but my balance would just be a little bit off, and then I couldn't recover, and I'd be on the ground. And I worked with you know, sports psychologists, did the traditional visualization, mental rehearsal, positive, you know, inverted commas, positive self-talk. And at the time, my self-talk originally was, "Don't fall off the beam, don't fall off the beam, don't fall off the beam." Someone smart said to me, "Rach, why don't you try to stay on the beam?" So I flipped my self-talk to, "Stay on the beam, I can stay on the beam," but you know, none of that stuff worked. Anyway, I never cracked it. I was a really good competitor everywhere else. So it wasn't like I wasn't a good competitor, but I couldn't crack why I could not do that move when the pressure was really on. And I think part of that too was because I would then start to anticipate, well, I've fallen already in big competitions. I'm almost coming into a big competition with that fear of learned experience of, well, I've failed already, so there's a fair chance I'm going to fail. You know, what's different? Especially because I couldn't work it out. Left gymnastics, or retired from gymnastics at 19, and as I said, you went and became a physio. And then part of physio training is actually, there's the traditional stuff that sport coaches and athletes will be familiar with, which is what, you know, the musculoskeletal side, the fixing injuries. But then there's a whole area on breathing, which is again around more respiratory pathology, so asthma, emphysema, a lot of those sort of lung illnesses. You know, had I been a physio still when COVID was a thing, I used to actually work with respiratory problems in the intensive care unit. So more breathing from a medical perspective. But along the way, as I was working 3 days a week, I was working in a clinic that was aligned with treating New Zealand's best athletes, some of the world's best athletes from the physical performance side, so treating physical injuries. But 2 days a week, I was working in a clinic where I would see panic attack, burnout, stress, anxiety, all of that stuff as a physio for those breathing related issues. And gradually along the way, I was like, I'm actually seeing the same stuff, but if I'm walking into the sports clinic, I'm looking at it through my very physical performance hat. If I'm walking into the breathing clinic, I'm looking at it, you know, completely differently. And as you and I know, like, humans aren't these nicely segmented silos. You know what I mean? Like, there's, I call it, what I do often, optimizing the gray. There's all of the stuff that overlaps in the deeper levels of performance. So basically, with breathing and where breathing sits in my world, again, it's not, I don't use breathing for relaxation. Mindfulness. There's a part of it where we hack into breathing to control what's called arousal state. We can get into that in a sec if you want to go down that route. Box breathing is a technique I would probably encourage people to find a better technique, and we can talk about that. It doesn't actually give them the benefit that they necessarily think it does, and some better things to do. But from breathing from a performance perspective, like, if you're breathing really well, you're breathing predominantly with your diaphragm, which is big muscle down your belly. If you're breathing ineffectively, you're breathing more with your upper chest. Now, upper chest muscles are also, as performance athletes, many of the muscles that they will use for generating power, stability, position, timing, all of those sorts of things with their upper limbs. And so when I and we see that sort of play over and over again, where often we'll have athletes who will practice a technique in a particular state, And they know their timing exceptionally well, exactly where they need to position their body. When they get into a high pressure moment and their arousal state increases, because of what changes the breathing patterns subconsciously, so they become more of an upper chest breather because that's part of that threat response. It changes the biomechanics and the timing of all of the upper limb and upper body and a whole lot of other things as well. So for me, coming back to that gymnastic stuff, like I'd come in, I'd practice that move pretty relatively relaxed, so I knew where to position myself. But when the timing, when the pressure was really on, and I'd been feeling nervous, I'd be a little bit more tight through my upper body, wouldn't recognize that, wouldn't realize what was happening. And then as I come into the board, my timing would be a little bit off, and then everything about the consecutive parts of the flow of that movement would be off. So that kind of makes some sense. So that was kind of, I was like, oh man, like, you know, and where does that sit in not just that physical biomechanics part of it, but there's all the head noise that goes on. Like, it's probably what you were feeling as a swimmer, you know. I don't want to be here, you know, what if I fail? I'm not good enough. Like, all of that noise that we have in our head often as athletes, you know, fear of what other people think, fear of failure, you know, all of that stuff is ultimately what underpins a lot of that stuff. So it's really quite a complex thing. Humans are complex, but they're pretty cool. But there's multiple layers to being able to get someone to execute in the pressure moment. And more often than not, it's less about what you do in the moment of pressure. It's actually about everything you front loaded coming into that. And to me, that's where a lot of the magic is in terms of when we're trying to work on performance with people. So that was kind of where I ended up. It was kind of one dot led to another, and at the time I didn't really see how they were joining. But it's been a privilege, you know, work with professional football teams, work with some, you know, number of NBA individuals, a lot of Olympic swimmers, you know, all sorts of sport codes all around the world, and it's really cool to be able to do that.
And you love getting on a plane.
It's not so much getting on the plane piece. I think it's what's at the other end of that. So, you know, if I'm getting on a plane doing long haul flying, it means I'm doing some pretty cool stuff with some pretty cool people, and I feel really grateful and quite privileged to do that. So I take that any day of the week.
Nice. I got loads of little threads. One is, well, A, I retired from gymnastics at 19 is ridiculous, isn't it, when you start to think about it.
No,
Sport and
that's
why
not
we do
it.
sports.
Yeah, and you know what? There is a gymnast who I competed against her at World Champs, and she is my age, and she's actually still competing. She's an absolute outlier, and she's done every Olympic Games since those 91 World Champs, which is really impressive. And she can still hold her own. She doesn't compete these days. She doesn't compete all four events, which when I was competing, you had to compete as a female gymnast. You competed four events. She now just specializes in one. But you know, to have had a couple of children, and I won't give my age away on the podcast, but you know, be in her 40s, and be still competing on the international age is very impressive.
Yeah, no. Then I thought, oh my God, when you were over here, why didn't I get you to do gymnastics in the corridor? That was my immediate thought. If only I'd known, if only I'd known all this stuff. And then I thought, oh, I'd really try to enter into this conversation with box breathing, something I'd heard the other day, and you know, it's not that good. So
Yeah.
like what's better than box breathing? Like, what type of things could people like get curious about? By the way, I'm also an asthmatic, and now I'm thinking that when we were sat together for almost 2 whole days, you're analysing my breathing, and I breathe. I'm not that good at breathing. I do breathe, but I'm probably
Yeah.
not good at it.
Yeah.
What
You're
would
very
you?
much a mouth breather.
I'm a mouth breather, but I appreciate that you kept that to yourself. What?
We're all friends here, right?
Yeah, I'm no way I'm ever sitting next to you again. What stuff would you could you know people get curious about in this area? Like, what type of breathing techniques would you be like?
Yeah, first of all, like, there's a big difference between breathing techniques and optimal breathing mechanics, right? So
I knew
the
that.
analogy of,
I was just playing with you.
totally. And just to you know, put a bit of caveat on, in 2008 I actually did my master's thesis, my research thesis on optimizing performance in competitive cyclists by changing breathing patterns. So from a performance perspective, 50,000 word document, you know. Now at the time I was also training, I'd gone back to New Zealand to do this, and I was training with a couple of guys who were former special forces, and so we were training a lot of the physical side of stuff, purely just because I needed a physical outlet for the mental challenge of being in the lab and doing research all day. And one of the guys said to me, it's like, right, how can you write 50,000 words on breathing? Like, seriously, it's not that hard. Breathe in, breathe out, don't stop. Like, there's six words there, you know? And these days, I'd probably shorten it to say, you probably only need three, or five, three being, you know, breathe out slowly. And then possibly don't stop on the end of that. So, you know, we can make it as complex or as simple as you want. The reason I say there's a big difference between breath work in inverted commas and, you know, breathing techniques is that versus breathing mechanics is we take 20,000 breaths in a day. And it's actually where you do those 20,000 breaths that has more of an impact on performance, both from the physical performance side and also the arousal state control perspective, than any, you know, 4 minutes of box breathing or 30 seconds of Wim Hof or whatever the techniques are. And I often use that analogy that it's kind of like, you know, if you had KFC for breakfast and, you know, McDonald's for lunch and Pizza Hut for dinner, and you took a couple of vitamins. The vitamins might take the edge off the crappy diet, but you've still got a really crappy diet and you're not going to perform well. And so, same thing with breathing techniques.
I think you just described my diet.
Maybe, hey?
It's my
No,
pyramid
look,
of breathing. Oh,
I
God.
was just going to say, and I was like, I don't want to go there. I don't want to drop you in it any more than I already have. But that's, you know, so liken that, right, to the breathing pattern, like how someone's breathing when they're not thinking about breathing is kind of like the diet and those breathing techniques, box breathing, breath holds, nasal breathing, you know, there's such a, it's almost, breathing's almost become the shiny thing from a performance perspective, which I think is fantastic that there's a lot of awareness on it. But I also think there's a lot of performance gains that are being left on the table, or there's people that are throwing the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak, because they try some techniques. They'll try box breathing, and if someone's not a great breather at rest and they try to do some cycles of box breathing, for some people it actually makes them feel a bit worse. They get a bit panicky with trying to hold their breath. And where I think, you know, the reason, one of the reasons I push back on box breathing but is when you ask people why do you do it, most people can't really give you an answer as to why they do it apart from that's what the Navy SEALs do. And that, to me, that's not a good enough answer, particularly when that's actually not true. So the stuff that was done with the SEALs around breathing from heart rate control and heart rate variability, so arousal state control, was done a number of years ago with a guy who's a clinical psych. He's a colleague and good friend of mine, and we actually talked a lot about the breathing patterns and those sorts of things. Box breathing became a technique that a former SEAL took when he needed to basically commercialize a part for part of his program, you know, as many former op guys might tend to go do from some of the communities. Where box breathing is, for those of you that aren't familiar with it, breathe in for 4 seconds, hold for 4 seconds, breathe out for 4 seconds, hold for 4 seconds. And you repeat that sometimes for 4 minutes, sometimes 4 cycles, you know, whatever kind of feels right. What was actually developed and where the research was around heart rate control from firearm accuracy and arousal state was breathing in for 4 seconds, out for 6 seconds, and 4 minutes of that. And there's some reasons for doing that, and a lot of it's related to your heart rate actually slows down when you breathe out. When you breathe in, it actually speeds up. And the out breath taps into your calmer nervous system. The in breath taps into the fight and flight or the wind up nervous system. So there's some real reasons why you use, you know, you manipulate that rhythm. Challenge with box breathing is if you're just sitting at your computer and you're on a deadline and you're feeling pressured, the box breathing might, in inverted commas, work okay because you're not actually pushing hard with your lungs. Like, you're not breathing hard and fast, right? But there's not actually a mammal on the planet that, when it moves hard and fast, can it, you know, it holds its breath at the top of the inhale. It's not something that we naturally do. And you ask any performance athlete, we know when they're pushing hard and fast, including our tactical athletes, you know, try to be sprinting as hard as you can for 3 kilometers or 2 kilometers, or, you know, do some, you know, if you're swimming or 45 minutes into a game of hard football or whatever it is, try to hold your breath for 4 seconds at the top of an inhale, and it actually panics people. Like, you can't do it. You know what I mean? It's actually not, it doesn't work in that scenario. So I think where it's got a place is it might be a circuit breaker. So if you stop and think about your breathing, that takes your mind away from whatever it was that you were stressing about in the first place, right? So ticking the box, fantastic circuit breaker, that's great. But my point is, if you're going to use a circuit breaker, use one that's actually going to be more optimized to giving you the benefits that you ultimately want, which is even just that, you know, breathe in 4 seconds, breathe out 6 seconds. Actually, if you're really pressured and you've only got time to really do one breath, or 2 breaths, doing a long, slow exhale is actually gonna, you know, your inhale is gonna be whatever it's gonna be. But actually really slowing down that exhale, sometimes breathing out through your mouth is totally fine too. You actually just slows everything down, drop your shoulders as you do that. So it's kind of, I hate being prescriptive with techniques because it really kind of depends on what your scenario is, you know, and there's a handful of them. I could give you like a little shopping list of them. But you kind of want to know what you're doing and why you're doing it rather than, oh, that's just because what everybody else does. Does that kind of make sense? Have you got?
I can now see why you wrote 50,000 words.
I was just going to say, aren't you glad
Not
you
because
asked
I
me that
was thinking
question? Because
this.
that's opening a can of worms. That's opening totally a can of worms,
Yeah,
right?
you've opened a can of worms in me because I also like I don't. I'm now obviously really aware of my breathing, and obviously like
Yeah.
it's automatic, isn't it? And you don't like not
Yeah.
optimal, by the way. There's only two times I'm normally aware. One is I was in the swimming pool yesterday trying to do lengths under the water, so which I could do, so that was good. And then the other one is when when I'm running, I used to count steps, but now I count breaths, and it feels much less painful, if I'm honest.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And you know, there's something even your listeners can just do a little self-check, because you're right, most of the time we don't think about breathing because it does happen subconsciously, you know, which is a good
Thank
thing,
God.
because we
Thank
I
God.
was just gonna say we'd get nothing else done, right? Like, seriously. So thankfully our very smart old evolved brain, the part of our brain that's been around for like since, you know, we were not really that smart, it decided that breathing could just be positioned in the part of the brain. It's just like a little metronome. So it just does what it does without us thinking about it. But most people in modern society, because we're often in go, go, go environments of pressure, you know, broken noses, asthma, rib fractures, you know, there can be dairy intolerance. There can be so many different things that causes someone's breathing to become less than optimal in the first place. But they start becoming an upper chest breather. So a simple little thing you can do, like, is just stand in front of the mirror, you know, with no shirt on, and just line your shoulders up with something behind you and see if your upper chest's going up and down, right? And most people, because most people, if they don't look at themselves in the mirror, they'll go, oh no, I'm breathing in and out with my belly. But that's actually quite different than when they actually get that visual feedback from what they see in the mirror. So does that kind of make some sense? Because at rest, like sitting here having a conversation with you, your upper chest should be completely still and your belly should just gently be going in and out. Not big, slow, deep breaths like holding for 8 seconds, but literally just a very smooth in and out. Now, if that's not your default pattern, you're inefficient before you even start moving. And then when you start running hard and fast, or you're, you know, moving more and you have to take deeper breaths, faster breaths, you get to a point where you're trying to breathe and it just, you know, you get to a point where it's called breath stacking. You feel like you can't get air into your chest because you're already at the top of your lungs. So it makes breathing really inefficient. There's a story I possibly might just wrap up all of this stuff so we can, you know, I'm sure we don't want to spend a whole podcast talking about breathing, but there's a golfer who I used to work with. He had his PGA card up in the States and he hit a form slump. Now, he'd been working sports psych, who I know, actually a really good psych, for about 8 years. And the psych had referred him to come see me about a year before he finally came in. And he hit a form slump where he lost his card. And then he ended up, you know, moving back home and was back living with family. And he came in about, you know, one morning, and golfers are really polite athletes, unlike some of the athletes that we work with, right? Very polite, and comes in, he goes, look, he goes, I had this appointment already, but I need to tell you that I've made a decision this morning. I'm done with golf. I can't crack this. And he goes, and this is where I apologize that I said to you, I might swear, but he goes, and to be honest, he goes, I don't need to learn this breathing shit. He said, because it's a waste of time. Psych's been using it for 8 years and it makes no difference. And I said, okay, cool. And I love challenges like that. I'm almost like, bring it on, right? And I'm like, okay, cool. So how's the psych been using breathing with you? And he was like, well, as part of my pre-shot routine, I step off the ball, I take three nice calm breaths to, you know, settle myself and control my state. I step in, I address the ball, and I play my shot. I'm like, brilliant. I said, how many shots in a pro round? And he looks at me like I'm a complete idiot. And he was like, well, 70. I said, okay. How long are you on the course for in a pro round? And he was like, well, anywhere from 4 to 4.5 hours. I said, okay, great. I said, so what you're telling me is the 4,500 breaths you're going to take in that round, 210 of them are designed to, in inverted commas, set your state. The other 99.6%, you're leaving completely to chance. And he kind of looks at me like, oh, I haven't got this breathing so well sorted. And then I could have a conversation with him about how he'd practiced his swing and his stroke in a very relaxed environment, relaxed position, relaxed body, mental state, you know, all that sort of stuff. So he knew exactly where to position himself for his backswing and his follow-through and, you know, making sure the club face hit the ball at the right, all that stuff, right? But then when he got into that pressure of, I've got to hit this shot, and if I miss this shot, then I'm going to miss the cut, and if I miss the cut, then I'm going to miss payday, and if I miss payday, then I'm not supporting my family, and all of that noise, right, would trigger that arousal state stuff for him. And now he's been on tour for, you know, however many weeks, and he's not sleeping so well, and he's got, you know, all this other stuff going on away from golf. That response that happens in the neurophysiology, so the nervous system and arousal state and emotional state and all that, all those messy pieces that makes us human, would cause his breathing to tighten up as part of that response without realizing that that would happen. And you know, he talked about all of that, those upper limb muscles, you know, he was using for breathing, but that would tighten up his swing, so his swing would be just a little bit off. And when we could actually, I guess, explain it to him in a way that put it took it out of the psych box. And a lot of our alpha performers don't like to know that, you know, performance under pressure often gets positioned into, oh, it must be a psych issue or you're mentally weak or whatever. And a lot of our elite performers don't want to know about that. They don't want to have that conversation, right? Because it's often not either, you know. But when we could actually go, hey, this is a physical, biomechanical, neurophysiology, hard science reason that you can't perform under pressure, he was like, oh, I can solve that, right? And sure enough, you know, we gave him some techniques to use on the course. We gave him some stuff to do, you know, just in practice and training. And then obviously there was a whole lot of life stuff we needed to help him clean up from some self-sabotaging behavior and, you know, fear of failure and all of that sort of stuff. And he was PGA Player of the Year and got his card back and was back playing exceptional golf. So that's, I guess, you know, use that story often to kind of talk about the difference between just having a couple of little techniques, you know, and the bigger kind of what actually really goes on in human performance and how all of those things really overlap and wind in on each other, which is where there's so much potential. I reckon, you know, so much potential for so many athletes and teams. You know, they think they're performing well. There's a whole other level of performance that they haven't even tapped into. You know, not even just someone who's got problems in inverted commas, you know, not people that this, I think you and I have talked about this philosophy where I often talk about, you know, it's not about fixing broken, it's about creating awesome. So you can have people come in that you know, think, oh yeah, they're still really performing well, or they might be winning games or, you know, whatever it is, but you can always take them to a whole other level of performance when you start to look at how do all of those areas overlap and what's not been optimized.
I've got loads of strands again.
Yeah.
But and then, yeah, I guess when you put it like that, like I take 20,000 breaths a day, and I love to say you're inefficient before you even start running. I'm definitely inefficient when I'm running as well. Then I was thinking about like, oh, already like Rachel's like analysing me, so I need to keep my upper body still. It's going to be weird later if someone walks in my room and I'm topless in front of the mirror checking my breathing. And then because you like pay attention to different things to me, so already like I'm thinking about like a couple of days together with ECAS, and like you're analysing everyone's breathing, and I'm not even thinking about it quite
And I'm not so much looking at their breathing, right? I'm looking, it's such a great giveaway on their arousal state, though. So, you know, you would have noticed that when, and sorry, you might not have noticed, but, you know, when the guys are about to go in to the hot seat, you know, and watch what changes, right? And their breathing will get a little bit tight and they get more into their upper chest and they might even take that, you know, that deep breath in and you could just see the tension in their face and, you know, all of that stuff, right? And that's because it's part of the human threat response. And the thing is that human threat response is so generic. It doesn't really matter what turns it on, but it gets turned on in a very predictable way, I guess, for humans. And we feel it in the same way. Now, the downside in the performance sphere is that it's not normalized. You know, like when I present to, you know, groups of special force guys, you know, it's like, hey, this is what happens. This is the human threat response. It's part of your neurophysiology. Every single human has it hard coded into us. It's very ancient. Everybody experiences the same stuff in the same way. Just different scenarios will bring it on for different people based on their tolerance. But by the way, who's experienced all of this stuff in the last, 3 weeks? And I'll put a list of stuff up. And every hand goes up, And I did it actually with a bunch of the first team coaches when I was over in the UK, with the Premier League head coaches summit, and same thing, ask that question. And those guys were less willing, I guess, to be vulnerable. But even, so those groups, I get them to shut their eyes and bow their heads so they can't see what their teammates are doing, but it's fascinating when you see that. And I say to the operators in particular, because they can see their teammates, I say to them, if you look left and look right at your teammates, would you have expected that they felt that stuff? And they're all like, well, no, because they think that they're the only one. And the problem with that is that they think that they're the only one because they look around and everyone else has got their performance mask on, which is appropriate. We're all very good at shutting off that emotion and getting on with the job and just executing. I'm a gold medalist in that, having been a gymnast where you get to shut emotion off all the time, but the downside of that is you don't know that everyone else is feeling that. So you think that you're the only one who's not cut out for that environment, and that actually undermines confidence even more. Whereas as soon as you go, hey, this is really normal, you're probably all feeling this. Anxiety is not the problem, it's what it does to your performance and how you manage that, from the arousal state control, not the mental experience of emotion. I'll leave that to the psych to deal with, but in terms of the neurophysiology, right? And it's very trainable, and we can optimize it. Suddenly they actually kind of go brings it out to the open. We go, hey, this is just another performance thing that we can actually optimize, rather than being this dirty little secret that no one wants to talk about, but everyone's experiencing and they don't know how to work with it.
Nice. If I wanted to, let's imagine Rusty wanted to change his breathing to optimize performance, or increase my tolerance.
Tolerance to humans, or tolerance to humans and idiots?
So I'm guessing you'd like make people aware first, top off in front of the mirror probably makes me aware of like what my current state is, and then are you working with people around them having some. Get some rituals or some stuff that helps them like get out of I mean, for me to change my breathing feels like it's quite a big thing because I've breathed like this for like 47 years. As you say, I'm asthmatic. I had my adenoids out at a young age. Lots of stuff that's, I guess, influenced how I currently breathe. Now I'm thinking I would love to change it and like be able to do that that mount that you mentioned earlier. Where would you start with someone like me, or am I just like it's too late for Rusty?
No, it's totally not too late for you at all. And there'd be multiple layers to it, right? And one of the things you'd find straight away is if we didn't actually have a conversation with you to go, hey, this is normal breathing, this is how you're breathing, some of that education piece. When we asked you to do some of the work you'd need to do to change it, it would feel so uncomfortable because you've been breathing how you've been breathing for 47 years, that your brain would do exactly what it's designed to do, which is to protect you and keep you alive, and it would fight it and it would say, I don't want to do this, right? It would give you awful feelings like air hunger, feeling like you're suffocating, you're not breathing in enough. Now, part of that is some really complex stuff, and I'll try to keep it super simple so I don't get bogged down in it, but where how I said to you, your breathing's got that little metronome, and so every time you take a breath, your brain sends your muscles and your body a message to say, breathe in this way. And then how the body kind of works is it sends a message back to the brain and it says, yep, we did what you told us to do. And as long as the out message equals the in message, as in like as long as the message from the brain down to the body is the same as the body up to the brain goes, there's no problem, keep doing what you're doing. When we try to change someone's breathing, for a while your brain's still going to be sending the downwards message to your body to say breathe in a certain way, but you're going to get a message back to your brain to say we actually breathed in a completely different way. And because breathing is literally the line between being dead and alive, right? You've got so many alarm systems built into your nervous system. They're called, based on carbon dioxide oxygen level, based on what's moving, based on how quickly you're breathing. Like there's all of these layers of triggers basically that are happening without you even being aware of it. So then your brain goes, uh-oh, Rusty, there's a problem because you're not doing what we're telling you to do. And the only time, if you think about it like a primal, very survival level, if there's a problem with your breathing, then nothing else matters until you get that breathing back to how your brain thinks that it stays alive like. Does that kind of make some sense? So we have to explain to you, first of all, that that's going to happen. You're going to feel uncomfortable. It needs to feel uncomfortable. You're probably going to feel that air hunger or that you're not breathing in enough, so that you've got that motivation, I guess, to ride through the discomfort. Then what we'd have to do is make sure that for you in particular, because you're a mouth breather, go, okay, does your nose actually work? Now, you've sat there for the last 30 seconds with your mouth shut breathing through your nose, right? So
Oh
your
my
nose
God,
actually
you're
works just
analyzing
fine.
everything I do. Stop it.
Of
Only because I'm really,
course.
only because I'm like really aware of it. Like,
Yeah, of course. But we know that
Mickey's watching me. I'm
totally.
going to keep my mouth closed and my shoulders.
Yeah. But
I'm not
we don't
breathing.
want to turn you into, we don't want to turn you, I was just going to say, you're probably breath holding, which is another thing that people do often. But we'd have to make sure you can breathe through your nose. Now, some people who have things like dairy intolerances, they're always stuffed up in their sinuses, for example, right? So we might actually say, hey, give dairy up for 3 weeks and see what happens. Then what we would probably do with you is we'd give you an exercise where 10 minutes every day you'd lie down, and you would train yourself to diaphragmatically breathe or belly breathe in and out through your nose without your upper chest moving. So you basically put your hands on your upper chest, deep breath in, full breath out, and you actually push down on your upper chest. So you're basically emptying all the air that you hold onto up here, push, let that go in and out through your nose. Feel your belly rise for about, I don't know, a second and a half. Going to fall for about twice as long as that, and then there's a pause at the end of the out breath. So basically what we're doing, that's not breathing for relaxation. Now, a lot of people go, oh, I do that at the end of a yoga class or whatever. That's not what we're doing. Do you know what I mean? It's going to be faster than that.
I'm running
It's
out of
going to
air.
get,
The minute I start changing, and that's what you speak about, isn't it? I'm like,
yeah, that's
I'm
the air
running
hunger
out.
feeling,
Yeah.
right? Yeah. And the reason we get you to do it lying down, Rusty, rather than trying to do it sitting up to start with, is like when you come upright and you're standing upright, sitting upright, you're working against gravity. Your core is going to kick in a different way. And it's actually really hard to, because most people tend to have it, brace through their core quite hard. And if you do it now while you're talking to me, tighten your tummy muscles as hard as you can and try to breathe into your belly at the same time, and you'll find that the two don't work together so well, right? So
You would start
because
me on
most,
level one. I am remedial
yeah.
breathing class, level one, lying down.
Pretty much, hey, which is quite ironic, isn't it? When, as you say, it's something we do all the time. Like, and this is why breathing falls over in the in the performance spaces, I think, because everyone wants the shiny, sexy, quick fix technique. You know what I mean? And that's only ever going to be a vitamin, And so you get to choose. You want the vitamins, and that's cool. They can still be helpful. I call them get out of jail cards. I've got to a point where I'm struggling with my breathing, or if we're looking at it from an arousal state perspective, my arousal state's crossed my threshold, and now I'm, my peripheral vision shut down, and I'm missing those cues and those calls from the sideline, and I'm fumbling the, my fine motor skills have disappeared, and my smart decision making brain's, gone AWOL somewhere, so that's where we use it from a performance arousal state perspective. You can use it. You can use a breathing technique to get yourself out of jail, but the most effective get out of jail cards don't end up in jail in the first place, which is where we often talk about that front loading piece. And so, and I say to people, pick your poison. Typically, if you're a real high performer, and you are driven to be one of the best in the world, you're not hardwired to be looking for shortcuts. Do you know what I mean? So you're not looking for the quick fix techniques. There's just a lot of people who live and work in high performance environments who I would challenge, are comfortable with near enough is good enough, and that's okay, that's fine, but they're never going to be those consistent world-class performers. Does
Wow.
that make sense? That probably sounds like a harsh call, but you and I have worked in performance environments for a couple, at least a few decades now, right? And you can tell pretty quickly the ones that, that's they still
Experience.
might be on a national team, right? But they will still go, yeah, but I'm doing enough. And then there's those amazing individuals who are like, yep, and I'm already in the national team, and how do I keep getting better?
Made me think, like, I was in the car the other day and I had to give my daughter some bad news, and like, just the impact on her breathing was all I could remember. I actually didn't know what I was actually like, really, like, freaking
Wow.
yeah.
And can you remember what the impact that was on your breathing right before you had to tell her?
No, I can't, but I only did it so that my wife didn't have to tell her
Wow.
because I thought it
I
would
mean,
stress.
that's
It would
beautiful
stress
that you did
my life
that.
more than it would stress me. I'm definitely going to be more aware of like some of the like those type of cues now. Obviously, I'm not going to know what to look for because I'm not an expert like you. It was then making me think about, so our time together to give it a bit of context was we were with ECAS with a good old Danny and Scott, and putting some coaches through different like scenarios with actors and actresses, like sackings and various things. And it felt really real. Like it actually feels real to me now, just remembering it. So I guess I will, what are the implications of your work? So I was, again, quite oblivious to some of the stuff, I guess, that you were doing. What are the implications for like training and, you know, you've spoken about people's tolerance and is it a whole, because again, you also only were there for like a couple of days with people. You're not there for like a longer period of time.
So in the world, like in the world from breathing, there's obviously the optimizing from the physical performance perspective, right? So it might be keeping a player on the field. Like I've had this often where there's a player who they literally get to the point that they can't breathe properly, you know, and they'll be medically cleared for everything, and it comes down to poor breathing mechanics. Or they, you know, I'll be engaged with teams where they want that edge from the physical performance, where they want their team to have the, you know, gas in their legs and their lungs in the last 5 minutes of a game, so that if it's really tight and it comes down, they've got the ability to push through. So we're optimizing it from that perspective. But then there's the whole arousal state, which is where, speaking of that, that those 2 day workshops, that's where that human threat response stuff really kicks in, right? And so for those guys, they were so outside their comfort zone, and the key things that'll turn that threat response on, which is where we get it, their heart starts racing and our breathing gets a bit narrow, and we, you know, and we sweaty palms and dry mouth, and gut gets a bit funny, and you can imagine how that then translates to performance. If your performance is required to have fine motor skills, accuracy, smart decision making, you know, all those sorts of things, right? And there's this constant balance between where is our arousal state and where is our threshold to feeling, you know, too up, because we're always going to feel nervous when we're outside our comfort zone. That response is going to kick in. That's really normal, but we want to be, you know, letting, I always think there's this dance, right, with our arousal state relative to our threshold, where we're always trying to just let it escalate as it needs to, but not have it cross our threshold so that performance becomes detrimental. And so for those guys, purely just being there for the weekend would have been outside their comfort zone. So they would have been coming into that weekend with their arousal state elevated. They didn't know what they were coming in for. They just knew they had to turn up, and it was like, maybe they did they know that they were coming in for a weekend on difficult conversations, or did they not even know that part? Like, I don't
No,
think
I
anyone
don't
knew
think they
that
do.
part.
I don't think they knew that that's part of
No.
it, let alone the enormity of the
Yeah,
task
right.
ahead of them.
Totally. And so, you know, fear of the unknown or uncertainty is one of the big things that will trigger that human threat response. It's a very well ingrained primal response that we have as humans, right? Is that if we don't know what the outcome of something's going to be, it's threatening to us. So the threat response becomes primed to go, just be ready, because it might be dangerous. We're not sure. So the nervous system gets ready for action. You know, uncertainty, unknown, being outside our comfort zone, and consequence of outcome is one of the other things that will trigger that threat response. So if it's a really big moment, as opposed to, or hey, there's lives on the line with this decision, or you know, something like that. So for those guys and how that would play out, you know, what ideally we give someone is the skills to go, rather than your nervous system reacting to the fact that you're in a difficult and an uncomfortable situation, here's some tools that you lay down, specifically things like, you know, just calmly breathing into your belly, maybe doing some of that 4 seconds in, 6 seconds out, you know, whatever. Or if all you've got time for is that one slow exhale, you know, for you about when you're about to give your daughter that bad news, just actually a breath into your belly and a really slow, controlled out breath. Lift your eyes, because if you lift your eyes, you're actually put another hack into your nervous system that turns on your calmer nervous system, not the threat nervous system. There's things we play with there. But for those guys, ideally, if we can keep their arousal state lower, knowing they're coming into a difficult conversation, they're still then keeping their smart brain online, so they don't say something that they hadn't intended to say, right? They stay totally in control of their emotional reactions to things. They don't get caught up in the other person's frustration or anger or whatever. And it's easy to do. You know, as humans, we get very caught up very quickly. If someone else in a room is angry or their body language is up, they look like they're about to attack us, you know, you'll feel yourself start to get escalated into that as well. But if you've got some tools in your toolkit to go, hang on a sec, I'm feeling myself get triggered by that, but how do I de-escalate my arousal state? you're going to keep your voice a lot calmer. You're then going to not look like a threat to the other person, all right? And then it's actually a really powerful way to de-escalate their state. So if we'd primed those guys, rather than it just being a teaching experience for them around what how do you say the right thing, if we were weaving into that whole workshop the skills around arousal state control in that, you know, is it would actually have said to them, hey, be aware of what starts to change. And if the actor or the actress, if you notice that they're starting to get upset or they're getting frustrated or they're getting angry or they're getting whatever, first of all, catch what your response is. But if you sit back in the chair, if you drop your shoulders, if you let your jaw be relaxed and you actually breathe into your belly a few times and you slow your voice right down, all everything about your body language and energy and vibe in that moment is going to be unthreatening to the person who's actually receiving the other end of that communication. So they now, their subconscious goes, huh, Rusty's actually not a threat. He's actually not about to go on the attack. I can actually de-escalate a little bit. And it's really powerful energy play. Like it's really, really powerful. But most people aren't aware of it. So they become reactive. And then, you know, they get tight and tense and their voice goes up and everything. And their shoulders get lifted because their breathing goes into their upper chest. And then to the other person's subconscious, it's like, oh no, Rachel's about to go on the attack because she's starting to get, you know, get big and, you know, puff up her chest. And does that kind of make sense? And then you go on the defensive and communication completely shuts down. So there's two layers, but one to optimize communication, but two to actually help those guys be in control of their arousal state so they felt better about having those difficult conversations. And they're still going to feel difficult. They're still going to feel so outside your comfort zone, right? You're still going to feel, and so does the performers, you're still going to feel anxious or up, you know, before those big moments. But the difference is you just haven't crossed your threshold, so it doesn't compromise your performance.
That all makes sense to me. I like it. Like the threshold makes sense that, you know, don't not escalating stuff is. And again, like obviously, I wish I'd done this podcast before we'd done the 2 days together, because then I would have listened in more to your stuff and noticed some more of the breathing stuff and people's. And again, like the people that did really well, like Michael's probably a good example, was like. Was good. It was good at that stuff.
100%. And you know, those guys had had a whole workshop on some of that stuff when we made them climb mountains and abseil and put them into, you know, so we'd already taught them some of that. But it's interesting because then when the task focus becomes something different, which for them and in their minds in that weekend was now I've got to learn how to have difficult conversations, because all of that other stuff wasn't automatic for them, holding two very new techniques in their head at the same time. How do I do this and do this at the same time? You know, so that's why I talk often about we've got a front load technique, so it's automatic for you. You know, I was working with a head coach of a professional team here in Australia who, you know, who would often lose it, you know, at half time if his team was down in the change room, you know, he'd be very, you know, yelling at his team and not yelling, but you know, very aggressive, and angry and frustrated, and you know, everything went wrong in the first half and all that sort of stuff, you know. And we've been doing some work, we had been at this point doing some work together, and just teaching him how to de-escalate his arousal state so he could actually push reset on it as he was coming into the change room at half time. And there was one particular game pretty early in the season where the team was down, you know, huge, huge margin, you know. And commentators have certainly written them off. And after the game, he phones me after the game. He goes, oh, I guess. And they turned the game around and they won by a significant amount. And he said, some of the senior players came up to me afterwards and they were like, you know, coach, don't know what you're doing, but keep doing more of it because you came into the change room at halftime calm. You weren't panicked. Your body language and your voice and your delivery was clear. I call it staying frosty. He said, it was clear and you gave us some very clear forward moving, what I call forward moving actions. What do we need to do next to move us closer to the outcome that we want? You gave us some very clear forward moving actions. You didn't even talk about the first half and what we'd done wrong, because actually in performance it's irrelevant. You do you know what I mean? It's like in this critical, there's plenty of time to do the hot wash after the game and pull it apart and dissect it and work out, you know, for making sure you don't do it again. But in that half time point, it's all about how do we take you from where you are now to getting you to where we need you to be for that outcome that we want. And the player said, you know, because you were calm and gave us really clear instruction, we were calm. We didn't panic. And we're just like, cool, we just need to go out and execute exactly what you've told us to do. And they did that, and they went for, they could take the field in that second half feeling calmer, in themselves. And again, calm, I use the word calm as a relative adjective in that environment. They're not sitting on a cushion going, om, do you know what I mean? They're still up and they're pumped and they're ready for the fight, but it's aggressively calm or calmly aggressive, depending on which way you want to phrase that. And that meant that they could have that good read of the field. The peripheral vision stayed wide open. They could see the player that was out to the side. Their ball handling was on point and amazing. The flow, the game plan that they'd remembered, because the team had then been optimized into the right performance state as a whole team, purely by how the coach had led that in the energy and him staying in control of himself. There's a lot of coaches that think going in and yelling at the team at halftime and, telling them how disappointed they, or that fear-driven coaching model is going to turn the team around. Well, it might on a one-off, and it might if that's a tool that you use every now and then, because sometimes it is appropriate to give your team a bit of a rocket up the backside. But if that's your go-to every single time, then what ends up happening is that, players and athletes end up shutting off to that, get very good at going, oh, here we go again, and they shut off and they miss the critical stuff. But worse, they go onto the field in that, escalated state, fear of making more mistakes, everything's tightened up, they misread the open field, all of that stuff and performance spirals. So it's not really a good performance strategy in my world.
And I guess what you're trying to make coaches aware of is that their arousal state and its impact upon others, and being more intentional around that
Yeah,
versus,
for
as you
sure.
said, leaving it to chance, really. I had the same feedback with Esther, did a bit of stuff in netball and asked the girls about like the coach, essentially asked them about the coach on a good day. And they referenced a half, halftime stuff, pre-match stuff. You were calm. Actually, this is what they said. They said, you were really well dressed. Your hair looked great. You were super calm. You gave absolute clarity on what it was that was going to take us forward. But also, what you're saying is that they heard even more of that stuff because actually, like, they weren't going, oh my God, like, here we fucking go again.
I've seen an interview with a professional player, football player, where they were interviewing, sorry, not interviewing, the cameras were on the coach in the coaching box giving this player an absolute bollocking. The player was on sideline with a headset, and unbeknownst to the coach, the player actually pulls the headset away from his head. The coach is still going off in the coach's box, but the player's basically going, you know what, I'm sick of hearing this stuff. I'm just going to take the headphones off so I don't hear it until I think he's done, and then I'll put the headphones on and acknowledge in inverted commas. But I actually didn't take on any of it because I'm sick of being yelled at and all that sort of stuff. Does that kind of make sense? And again, I've got to be really clear. I'm not, it's not kumbaya and, all of that sort of, do you know what I mean? That's not what we're talking about. It doesn't have to be, oh, they were always calm and I felt very chill. That's not the reality of the performance environments that we work in, but it's knowing, how do I need to show up in a way that's going to bring the best out of my team, my players, my operators, if it's, in a military environment on field, in a way that actually, because if you yell at someone, give someone a bollocking, usually their brain goes immediately to try to defend against that in their head. No, I'm not a dickhead. Like, what do you mean? And so they get sidetracked in their monkey mind, you know what I mean? Rather than going, oh, hang on a sec, what was actually the instruction that the coach actually really wanted me to do? And operating into that. And I think some of that I learned very much as a gymnast, the impact, and I didn't really realize it at the time, the impact that having a coach who was, always angry, always yelling at someone, always, picking on someone who wasn't doing the right thing, you never really heard the stuff that you were doing well or that you could improve on in a way that was constructive. It was always just the negative, or she was blowing up at someone or kicking someone out of the gym or, whatever. So even if she'd been in a good mood on a particular day, because as athletes, and particularly younger athletes, don't have the mental maturity that you and I have as 40-year-olds. You know what I mean? To have to go, oh, we've got enough life experience under our belt. You kind of start to go, oh, that's not personal. Often our younger athletes, that their brains haven't fully evolved to that point, that they don't take some of that stuff on board, or it's personal, or they've just got different processing, speed of processing, lots of stuff. So she might have, our coach might have been in a really good mood. But we were so, I was so, she was a threat. Do you know what I mean? I was always on edge just being around her, because usually if she wasn't blowing up at me, she was blowing up at someone. Does that kind of make some sense? And so for coaching, just even being aware of that, because it might be that you've had a really crappy day, you've got a whole lot of stuff going on. It's got nothing to do with your sport. But if you come into your performance environment, whether that be coaching or, game or tournament or whatever, but you allow any of that to come in, even though you might not say it, but your energy, your vibe, your body language is tense and busy and stressed, your players pick up on that and they think it's about them and the scenario that's happening at that moment, not the fact that your cat died or, someone cut you off in traffic in the way in the morning, that's actually what's really escalated your arousal state. So having some ways just to catch your reaction, your arousal state reactions, taking ownership and control of it, and actually setting it in a way that's going to bring out the best in the performance team that you're leading, to me makes a whole lot of sense. It's just another leadership tool,
Well, I'm sure you're pleased that you're doing what you're doing now, but I'm sorry for your gymnastics experience.
I'm not. I'm actually really grateful for it, to be
Yeah,
fair,
no, there
Rusty.
you are. But there'll be other
Yeah,
people that are
yeah.
less there'll be other people that are less grateful.
Sure.
And that we don't necessarily see those eggs that have been broken. And it's like, yeah, lots of stuff again that I want to go and speak to my daughter's synchronized swimming coaches and go, you might want to go and look at Rachel Vickery. What if people wanted to reach out and get in touch, where's the best places?
I'm not particularly active on social media. I do tend to be a fly under the radar and just get stuff done kind of person. So probably direct email, to be honest. Keep it really simple. Rachel, RACHEL at rachelvickery.com. And probably put that in the show notes. That's direct email. And probably LinkedIn is a place that I'm probably the most active.
Nice. I think you come
Really
through.
open, really open for people to reach out. Totally. As I said, I just don't post a whole lot of stuff.
No, that's cool. I love the fact you think I do show notes and all of that, but not that organized. I'll write a couple of little sentences. So I appreciate your support. Vickery, until we
Problem.
meet again, it's awesome. Like, got me thinking lots. Can be really aware of my breathing today. I sat next to Simon in a car yesterday for an hour and I was really aware of his breathing. And I kept thinking, that's me as well, because he's a mouth breather. And I thought, wow,
Yeah, it's
that's pretty rare.
interesting,
And my wife always
eh?
tells me off for it as well. Maybe I need to like reconfigure the computer.
Yeah, it's actually really easy to turn it around. Like it's not gonna take a lot of work. It's just knowing what work to do, so making it smart.
I'm gonna
I'll help you with that, Rusty. We'll get you
Yeah,
breathing in no
well,
time.
come on,
In
Vickery.
the meantime, before it in the meantime, before I see you, please don't stop.
I'll do my best. A pleasure as always. Have an amazing evening, as it is for you. I'm about to go and coach.
Yeah.
Bye. So,
Yeah,
I'll catch you
thanks for
soon.
getting up early. Yeah,
Cheers.
appreciate it. Thanks, Rusty. Take care. See ya. Bye.